Welcome to On The Menu. This is co-host Peter welcoming you to our show for this week. Miss Anne isn't with us, but she will be back next week. And I want to let you all know, those of you who have been worrying about her, that she's feeling very much better and should be back at full strength very soon. We've got a wonderful mixed bag program today. First of all, a celebrity chef who was visiting Pittsburgh, and Peter had a chance to catch up with him. Then a fascinating new vodka product and the story of how it came to be. Someone from a company called Xylis, a Swiss company which makes the most wonderful, beautifully designed kitchen gadgets. A worldwide expert on chocolate, and who knows, there might be more. So let's get this show on the road. There probably isn't a larger personality in the culinary world than Chef Paul Prudhomme, physically and otherwise. So when he was in town, it was just absolutely vital that Peter go to the trouble to try to reach him, and a large crowd of people were surrounding him when we did that, as you'll be able to tell from the interview.
Pittsburgh is thrilled to welcome Paul Prudhomme, and as you can hear in the background, there are quite a lot of people who are doing that, because On The Menu is at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh for a special reception and dinner. Chef Paul Prudhomme is the star. They're producing food in his manner. But he's here for a different reason than that, really, a very special reason. And listeners, I want you to hear it directly from him.
Well, the school is a really generous effort they're making to help us in Louisiana, and they've offered a scholarship for male or female for 4 years, everything paid. All they had to be was a citizen of New Orleans or the area. And so that's why I'm here. I'm excited about it. We're going to pick a great candidate for them to have. And it's just a wonderful thing for them to do. It's a lot of money, and we appreciate it. We've got so many people in the city of New Orleans that need help.
I think the value is estimated about how much?
I think probably about $120,000 to $140,000.
And have you had any input into this evening's food?
No, I just got here, and as you can tell, I've been swamped the whole time with pictures, so okay. I haven't done anything, but I'm going to be cooking as soon as this interview's over. I'm going to go over there and start cooking, because that's what I really love to do.
Okay, so what are some of the special dishes you're going to do tonight?
Well, you know, I have always love to be surprised, and the people that are with me that brought everything, Sean McBride, who's the president of my company, has been with me for over 25 years, you know, I mean, everybody that's here, you know, they know what I like, and they're putting something out there, and I don't know what it is, and I'm going to go out, and I'm going to do something with it, and it's a really good thing, fun thing to do.
It sounds great. Now, we talked before we started recording about how nice it would be if other institutions stepped up like the Art Institute has done. Paul, if someone wanted to do that, how would they go about getting in touch with you?
Well, my executive assistant's name is Margie Blue, and Margie is at the Seasoning Company, and she's there Monday through Friday, and she will take anybody's call that says they want to meet me or they want to talk to me. And the number is 504-731-3500, and it's Margie Blue.
Let's do that just one more time. The telephone
is 504-731-3500.
Chef Paul, do you have any other kind of message for the good citizens of Pittsburgh while you're here?
Yes, I wish them good cooking, good eating, good loving. We love you guys out there.
Thank you so much.
I had to go to work.
Yeah, you had to go to work. Yeah. People came to see you cook, right?
Pittsburgh was certainly having a good time. You can tell that, can't you? Anyway, change of pace now. You might think that everything could possibly be done with the beverage vodka has already been done. There are so many different kinds, so many different flavors, so many different new cocktails. But there's always something new, and when there is, On The Menu, sure to find it. Dan Gotlin wasn't satisfied with his day job, listeners. And I think his day job is he's some kind of lawyer. I'm not sure what kind. So he decided that he would make the 21st century equivalent of bathtub gin. Dan, tell us the story of how this came about.
Okay. Well, several years ago, actually it's probably closer to 5 years ago by now, I represent an individual that's very, very well known in the jewelry industry and the entertainment industry. His nickname is Jacob the Jeweler, and I did all his legal work. And Jacob is from Russian ancestry, and in his store that he has on 57th Street in Manhattan, he had always served up what his family would make back in Russia for generations. They called it vodka, and everybody loved this product. They thought it was a great tasting item, and it didn't look like vodka because when you went into to look at it, it was greenish. And that's because it had cardamom seeds in it, and it had saffron. But his family was making this. Everybody loved it. And one day Jacob said to me, how'd you like to go into business? You're in charge. I want you to duplicate this item. And after you can duplicate it, we'll make the fanciest bottle in the world and go into the vodka business. So he left it up to me, and, you know, I did a lot of searching and, you know, looking around. And we tried to get a product that was similar to Jacob's, because Jacob's vodka that he was making was actually made from raisins, which is a grape in reality. And we tried to duplicate it, and we even had to test it in a lab. And it turned out that there were so many items in it that, first of all, it wasn't a vodka. It was more of a grappa than anything else. Clearly wasn't a vodka. It had so many impurities in it that it could have never been approved to sell as any type of item. So we went on a search, and we figured, let's try and do a grape vodka and see what we can do about, you know, locating a good place to make a different type of product, a grape vodka. But before that, we had gone to Jacob, one of his family members, to see how they made this product. I remember it was a Sunday afternoon, and I went with one of our partners. We went to the house, and lo and behold, they had a pot still in the house. I thought we were doing moonshine here for a little while.
No, but I think you were.
Yeah, they were making this item, and you know they were brewing it. You know, I was really hard to believe. I thought I was in a television set.
Yeah, you felt, and as an officer of the court, I guess you felt sort of
right. Like, yeah, I said, well, you're not allowed to be doing this. You can't do this. So they were making it, and lo and behold, the still fell over. And I said to myself, oh, my God, let's not have an explosion here where, you know, ATF comes and said, you know, it's a bomb-making factory in the apartment. But in any event, you know, they were making them. It was amazing. I mean, they were really, you know, they were really makers of liquor. I mean, you know, they did it for generations that way. But we refined it. You know, we found, you know, the proper way to do it. We used a pot still, a more sophisticated pot still than they did. And we eventually made a design, a bottle, which is truly spectacular, cut like a diamond.
Now, how long did this all take? You said you started on this adventure 5 years ago, but today it's still sort of a new thing.
Right. It we really only came into the market officially this summer, and we were still doing it on a limited basis. We started in New York. Our product is now sold in New York, and it's being sold in Pennsylvania in certain locations, and eventually we're hoping by mid-year of 2008 we'll be in all the major markets. You know, it's an expensive vodka. It's a different tasting vodka because it does have a grape base to it, and because of it's individually batched and the way it's made, and it's clearly more expensive than all the other vodkas, but we think it's well worth it. It's because it really is almost like a lifestyle. We designed a pouch to go with it to fit Jacob's motif, to make it look like a jewelry pouch almost.
Oh yeah, it's a magnificent. It's sort of a royal purple color with silver braid, as I recall.
Right, correct.
Absolutely amazing. Now somebody's making this for you. You're not making this in your backyard.
No, we're not doing it in my house or in my backyard or Jacob's anymore. It's made in California. We use grapes from California, the finest grapes, which we think are produced in the United States, are in California, and they use mountain water, and you know, it's distilled several times and bottled in California. So we're very happy with all our supplies. The only thing that's actually not made in the United States is the bottle, which is made by a famous glass company that makes a lot of the premium bottles. And it took over a year, between a year and 2 years, to get the bottle designed properly because of the intricacies in the back of it. It was not an easy process.
Now, why is it not grappa? I mean, what makes it vodka? I mean, how do you make it vodka rather than the grape based version of grappa?
The proof, it's a higher proof.
Okay.
And so that's what distinguishes it, and that's what makes it into a vodka, because basically vodka is really one of the more simpler items in the liquor in the spirits field to make. It's just you have to get it up to 190 proof, neutral spirit, and most of them are made from potato or grains, and then you get an ethanol, and then it's filtered. The difference that you get when you use a pot still, which is what we're using, is that you don't lose the complete flavor, the smell, the taste. So you have something left other than, drinking something that doesn't taste like anything.
Okay.
We have a taste.
But a lot of the grape flavor goes away.
Right. That's from the distillation process, and it's filtered. Right. So a lot of it does go away, but you still have a residual. Most people that are familiar, that are wine drinkers or familiar with grappa or other liquors, when they smell this, they will say, "Well, this." They can detect the grape, the essence of grapes in the product, which is great, because that's what we really wanted to achieve. We didn't want to be just a common run of the mill vodka in an inexpensive bottle, and anybody can do that. We wanted to be something that was unique and different, and we believe we've achieved that.
Yeah,
we hope we have anyway.
Yeah, we met a family in Italy which dominates the artisanal grappa business. The family is called Nonino, and one of the first things that they did was they started making single grape variety grappas. And grappa, as you probably know, is made not from grapes but from the must, from the skins and the stems and everything that's left over afterwards. But then they started making a product called uve, and uve is actually grappa made from grape juice. So it's very similar to what you're doing, except somehow they must be leaving more of the flavor in.
Correct.
Now
it's probably not the high proof that we have, and it's probably not filtered as many times.
Right.
Distillation process is probably a little different. The interesting thing about the vodka that we make in the pot still, it's made more like a whiskey or a cognac, whereas the traditional vodkas that are made are made in column stills, huge vats, and it really takes everything out of the product. And we didn't want that, and
So they take everything out, and then they put a little bit back in.
Right.
Have you run across a gin called Bucharest? No, a Broker's gin.
No.
Okay.
Wrong one. Ironically, I was the only one in my family that didn't drink before this.
There you go. Now you do, and you only drink Bocage.
Absolutely.
We had a guest a couple of weeks ago named A.J. Rathbun. He wrote a book, the definitive book on cocktails, called Good Spirits.
Oh, okay.
If you're interested, you should find the book. It's really an excellent book. In fact, you can buy it through the On the Menu website if you like. But I was talking to him about vodka, and I said a lot of people frown on vodka and say, it's really doesn't taste of anything, and why would anybody want to make cocktails out of it? And he took a differing view, and he said what it is it's a blank canvas. So in fact, it's really very helpful in constructing cocktails, because you want something blank and alcoholic to which you can add all kinds of other things that just don't happen to be alcoholic and therefore don't really qualify as cocktails.
Right.
But I did talk to him about Bocage vodka. He had not heard of it. I said, well, you ought to look out for this. But I think it would be a challenge to make cocktails out of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I've been to several people that, specialize in that. And we actually had one made, for the holiday season called a Bocage Cocatini. It's made, they have a picture of it in style on their website and in a couple of other places, that it was made in a Spanish restaurant for us. And it's absolutely delicious, but this product really mixes tremendously with everything. I mean, it's such a nice taste. And the thing that Jacob and his entire family, the grandfather, they all insisted that we wanted to make sure they would test it. They'd bring home a bottle and make sure that they didn't get a hangover the next day. They down a bottle of the vodka, and it really, for some reason, doesn't give you a hangover the next day, which is truly, if you want to drink a lot, that's something nice to see.
Now, are you adding back into the mix the kinds of things that Jacob, you said they used to put cardamom and things like that into it? Are you doing that as well? Or?
We have not done that yet.
Okay.
I mean, but this is, you know, this is the first product. Ultimately, we'll probably, you know, if we are successful, which we hope to be, we will probably produce some other similar products, you know, with maybe different flavors, maybe adding in the cardamom seeds, maybe adding in saffron to give it some color and, you know, to a little difference. He actually, one of the things he did do, he designed one of the bottles. You're familiar with the bottle. It has letters look like platinum. He actually, in his store, has a bottle that is all diamonds, the letters.
Oh, my goodness.
It's spectacular.
Yeah, that's
all you have to do is want to be able to pay about $5,000 for a bottle of vodka, and you can have that one.
Well, that's amazing. It still has, to me, has a haunting flavor of grappa, and I would still drink it as much after dinner as I would before dinner. Listen to that. I mean, that's just my own personal take on this product. I don't know what you think about that, Dan.
Well, as long as you drink it, we don't care if you drink it before dinner, after dinner, or during dinner.
Yeah, you can have it for breakfast in the morning if you
like. Absolutely. Well, you know what? I wouldn't suggest that.
Now,
that's how I learned about the liquor business when I was a young kid growing up. I worked in a brewery in the summers. I had a great job, and I used to go in 7 o'clock in the morning. Instead of coffee breaks, they were drinking beer. That wasn't for me at 7 in the morning.
Did anybody ever tell you the story of how grappa got started? I'm sure it probably applies to a number of other spirits as well, but did you ever hear the story of how it all began?
No.
It began in the mountains of northern Italy, where the houses were not heated, and the man of the house would have to get up and go out and do his work, whatever it was, which is probably outside farming or sheep herding or something like that. And he needed a kickstart in the morning in order to get his body going because the house wasn't heated, so he was extraordinarily cold when he was getting up. So they started using the rubbish, the must of the vines and anything else they could find that had some residual sugar in it. And then they made this homebrew, and that's exactly how grappa got its start. And I suspect that might be the same with vodka and other spirits, but I don't know that.
Vodka was originally, you know, I think they did back to the 12th century, but they do say that when it was originally started, it was people that were making it, which, you know, they wanted to keep warm.
Yeah,
well, maybe in the oil crisis we can, you know, we can we can use it.
There you go. Yeah, our gas heater on the third floor just went out, so I'm going to have to stash a bottle of Bocage.
Right, pour some in.
That'll help me along. Anyway, let's get some details. You mentioned to me a couple of weeks ago that for listeners here in Pennsylvania, you are in the process of negotiating with the PLCB.
Right. We actually, you know, our distributor in Pennsylvania is Southern Wine and Spirits, and they, I think it's in the on the market there in certain places.
Yes.
But we hope at the next meeting, which is in early December, first week in December, that we're approved, and then we'll be in, you know, major liquor stores, things like that. I think we're in some clubs and restaurants already, and I know we sponsored some charity events.
Right.
But we expect to be really expanding the next month or so.
Well, Southern's a great group. You're with someone who knows how to navigate lots and lots of the states, but especially the one that we call home here in Pennsylvania, where buying liquor can be a fairly difficult experience.
Right, and it was a really learning experience for me how difficult it is to sell sell liquor or produce liquor, because those are the licensing requirements. It's amazing. People don't realize that, you know, we make vodka. I can't go into a store and sell it to the store. I can't sell it to an individual if I want. We're not allowed because of it's so regulated, the industry.
It especially is in Pennsylvania. Anyway, there must be a website.
Yes.
Go ahead.
It's bocagevodka.com.
Now spell that out. It's
bocagevodka at AOL.com.
Okay, so you don't have an official website, you just have
We do. What am I saying? I'm giving you mine. It's bocagevodka.com. That's the website.
Bocagevodka.com. And is there a store locator on there?
We're in a lot of liquor stores in Manhattan. There's no, you know, we don't have our own facility, you know, our own store, but, you know, you can buy it if you want. You can either contact Southern Wine and Spirits in New York. They will tell you where to get it. Okay. Or you can call our number in at the office, and I can put you in touch with whoever's necessary. Our number is 212-343-2101, and I know that all the locations that it's sold at, all the restaurants and clubs that now carry it.
Well, best of luck in your newfound career.
Thank you as a
distiller. Is that what you are?
I guess. I mean, from law to becoming a distiller, I don't know.
Right. Well, it's a fascinating story. Dan, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. We're pleased that you're able to join us for this program, and Miss Anne's helping out on the next track, because one of the things that is a great favorite of hers is finding out new gadgets, new little ideas, new little doodads, thingamajigs, whatever you like to call them, that help make life just more convenient in the kitchen or wherever the eating and drinking might be going on. And Anne's known about a company called Xylus, a Swiss company, very stylish company for 40 years or so. But we recently discovered that they have some really exciting new products, so we couldn't resist inviting them to join the program.
We're talking to Betsy Bowers from Xylus USA. Hello, Betsy.
Hi, Anne.
I've been recruited to tell you my famous Xylus story, which is probably how we ended up interviewing you on behalf of Xylus for the radio show. Is that I have been this long, long time fan, and we're going back to the 1970s, and I was moving to Australia, and I had to edit all my possessions, and because I was flying with my possessions, and I went through everything, and the one thing I could not part with was my Xylus garlic press. And so there I was packing up my garlic, my Xylus garlic press to take to Australia as an absolute essential. To close the story, I actually enjoyed it, of course, in Australia where I did cook a lot. But I ended up in $200 in overweight luggage based on that kind of rationalization of what was absolutely essential in my life.
We're happy that
now
we
I'll,
made
I'll
it
pass this to you, Betsy. Explain to us, it is a Swiss company, I understand. Explain to us the structure of Xylus and what you're most known for and some of your award-winning products.
Will do. Thanks, Anne, for that story. I'm glad we made the cut when you were packing up to move to Australia. First of all, Xylus is a Swiss company. We are mainly known for our salad spinner, our food chopper, our garlic press, as you mentioned, as well as our rotary cheese grater. Those are the four products that are really the core products of the Xylus line, and that's flanked by all kinds of cooking and serving utensils, spatulas, and peelers and all kinds of good stuff. So that's what Xylus is mainly known for. Our salad spinner, I would say, is our number one most recognized item.
Now, how do you manage to compete in the United States as a Swiss company with just such a small product line?
Well, we have a pretty extensive product line. It's growing every year. Our product innovation is something that's on the forefront of our business. It's something we spend a lot of time and resources in constantly fine-tuning and innovating in the housewares category that we're a part of. It's something that we have been focusing on for the last 7 years, and that's why we have such strength in our brand. Xylus is all about reliability and quality in our products and the constant innovation.
And very stylish pieces, too, I might add.
Very aesthetically pleasing, I agree.
But Anne's talking about a garlic press that she owned. I don't want to give away too many secrets, but it's well over two decades ago.
Right, and I'm sure it still is performing like a gem.
I think it got lost somewhere along the way.
Oh no, that's sad to hear.
Yeah, I don't know what the end of it was. Perhaps Anne can tell us. She doesn't want to tell us.
Well, I'll tell you, the garlic press hasn't really changed too much in the years since we've been manufacturing it. It's still very much similar to the garlic press that Anne probably owned and then moved with her and then lost. So
now, what's it made from? It's very, very light.
It's very lightweight. It's aluminum. And our Susie 2 garlic press that's out in the market now is actually coated with a nonstick coating that allows for easier cleaning, and it also doesn't retain odors.
Now, that's the one that you sent us.
Yes, that's correct.
And then you've got something as low-tech as the little bottle stopper.
It's such a good gift item, especially with the holidays coming up. We feel a lot of our tools are very giftable. The Xylus bottle stopper is something that everyone needs multiples of. You can put these bottle stoppers into a wine bottle. You can also store your oil or vinegar bottles with the bottle stopper. It's a really cute little mechanism, very easy to give to somebody, perfect for stocking stuffers. And we feel like it's one of those flanking products that a lot of people have these Xylus bottle stoppers, and they tell me about it. But it's just, you know, this tiny little bottle stopper. It doesn't compare to the ingenuity and the innovation in our mandolins and our salad spinner and our food choppers, but it's something that Xylus is very well known for as well.
It's absolutely essential for those for those people who like to buy San Pellegrino sparkling water in 33-ounce fluid ounce bottles.
Is that what you use it for?
Well, I actually used to use something else until I got this.
Well, fantastic.
Because of all things, the people from San Pellegrino are so crafty that their largest bottles only have like a regular beer cap on top of them. Mm-hmm. So once you open them, you have to use them all up, otherwise the water goes flat.
Exactly.
So I have this little device that I found in Europe that didn't do a terribly good job, but it was better than nothing. But the bottle stopper now is absolutely terrific. Now the funny part about it is when San Pellegrino, you know, sells a 750 milliliter bottle, that comes with a screw cap. So I think they're exploiting the public here somewhere, but listeners...
There's a hidden agenda, is that what you're telling me?
Those of you who like to buy the bargain large-size San Pellegrino now have an answer. You can get the bottle stopper, and here's probably a good point at which to make sure they know how. So Xylus products are available how?
Xylus products are available at a lot of our national major accounts, such as Bed Bath & Beyond and Linens and Things. We're also available online. We have a limited number of products in Sur La Table, Crate and Barrel. But a lot of our products are available online and the independent retailers. So when we first started to distribute here in the United States, we focused more on the independent retailers, the kitchen shops, the mom and pop shops. And so they've continued to support our brand because we do have a very reliable product, something that's very durable. And people, once they start to use Xylus tools, they come back time and time again. And as we continue to develop these products and they're easier to store or easier to clean, I think that as people continue to cook more and more at home because of health reasons, they're trying to eat healthier, or maybe just to spend some quality time with the family. I think that Xylus really does play a part in their kitchens, and they continue to come back to these, you know, kitchen stores as well that, you know, for the longest time were the bread and butter, and they really appreciate the Xylus product for all of the innovation and the craftsmanship.
Now, you mentioned online, does that mean using a website of Xylus?
Yes. You cannot purchase items on our XylusUSA.com website. However, you can go to XylusUSA.com, and there is a store locator, and that will direct you to stores in your area for Xylus tools. Or you can use our Buy Online section, which does direct you to online retailers that carry almost all of our Xylus products.
Okay,
it's very easy to use.
So you're being very careful not to compete with your distribution channel. Is that the right answer?
Well, we would love to make our products available online, and hopefully someday it'll be easier to purchase those through the XylusUSA.com website. But at this time, we direct them to our distributors. That's correct.
Okay, so you must have some new ideas, some new gadgets. We're always interested in gadgets. We need to know what the next gadgets are going to be.
Well, I don't know if I'm privy to tell you, Peter.
Well, come on. You have to. We have to have some news on this program.
Well, I'll tell you. We've got a host of new products that are coming out at the beginning of the year. We typically try to launch our new, you know, all of our new gadgets at the Houseware Show in Chicago, also at Ambiente in Frankfurt. So those are the two key shows where we do debut all of our new gadgets. This year we've got a lot of, I would call it redesigning and innovating in tools that we currently have, and we're excited about coming out with these new tools. So I don't want to give it away just yet, but there are a host of new Xylus products that will be available probably beginning in March.
Okay, the Housewares show in Chicago is when?
Is in March, okay. And Ambiente is at the beginning of February.
Okay, Ambiente, that sounds like fun.
It is. I'd love to be able to go sometime. I get to hear stories, but I haven't yet been myself. So.
Now you're based here in the United States. Did you join Xylus in the USA? Or?
Yes, I did. I joined Xylus 3 years ago in California. We're located in Southern California.
Well, let's see. I can't believe we don't have more to say. Betsy, come on.
Well, I think what's really important for people to know about Xylus is simply that, as like I was saying, as kitchens and spending time with your family, as those kinds of things are on the forefront of what's important at the core of people now these days, I think what's really nice is that we can spend time with you in your kitchen. We can make your kitchen experience easier because of the gadgets that we have. I remember when I first started working at Xylus and I didn't have a whole lot of kitchen tools, and now my kitchen is plumb full of wonderful Xylus products, and it makes the cooking experience so much more fun. And I think that the fun aspect of cooking is enhanced with our Xylus tools. It's something that I think is very key, and we really try to focus in on our design so that consumers, when they are in their kitchens, they really have a more enjoyable experience.
And they have tools that really work.
Tools that really work, that stand the test of time. Xylus is also known for our colors. So not only do we have a really great tool, but we provide different colors. And for the longest time now, people have been able to accent their kitchens with color, and that's something that's really important to them. And we've been able to see the benefits of having our tools in colors that really appeal to this aesthetic, this aspirational type of cooking where your kitchen is beautiful and it's a place where you spend a lot of time and it's a place where you can really become one with your family, spend some quality time, and we feel like we're a part of that experience. But keeping in mind that, yes, these tools do stand the test of time. So it's fantastic. It's a wonderful product. The Xylus, the entire array of Xylus tools continues to grow. So we're constantly developing new tools and improving upon the ones that we have.
Now, is it a sort of a Swiss thing? I mean, the Swiss are wonderful at making fine crafts pieces like watches. Is it a sort of a national characteristic that's represented by these designs?
Yes, I think so. A lot of what goes into our tools to stem from that, From the beginning of time, when Xylus was first started, there was a gentleman by the name of Carl Zeisset, and he was in Switzerland inventing bicycles, and he was a handyman of sorts, and he started to use his know-how in developing bicycle parts to relate to other items that used similar function, whether it was a cranking wheel or something of that nature. He then started to develop the salad spinner, the rotary cheese grater, things of that nature, because he had this experience.
Oh, I see. So it was a common thing of things that went round.
Exactly. It was something that when he first started, the craftsmanship and the quality and the durability and the engineering was important. As the brand has continued to develop, the Xylus tools all have a very aesthetically appealing design. It's very European in nature as well, so it's got an overall international appeal, I believe, for people. So, but yeah, we started. We've been making kitchen tools now for 60 years or so. So, a lot of history.
Well, we so much appreciated your joining the program today. You want to do that website for us one more time?
Yes, thanks, Peter. It's xylususa.com. That's ZYLISSUSA.com. And on our website, like I said, you can refer to our entire assortment of products, and you can also visit our website in order to find a store located near you that does sell Xylus tools. And we do also encourage you to check out our buy online section so that if you are interested in purchasing Xylus tools online, you can find them as well.
Well, Betsy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on the
Thanks,
menu.
Thanks, Peter, and thank you, Ann, very much. We appreciate your what you do for our industry, and we really appreciate being a part of this show.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. We're delighted that you're able to join us for this program. And don't forget, go to our website, www.onthemenuradio.com, to explore all of the resources that are there. We'll be adding programs going back to the very beginning of the show in 2004, very soon, adding a new highlights section, some of the leading lights we've had the opportunity to meet and interview over the years. That you'll just be able to go directly to the specific interview that you want instead of having to just find the show and then listen through. So we think that'll be much more convenient for you. If you have any suggestions for how you'd like additional information presented, don't hesitate to let us know. Let us know that, or comments of any type at On the Menu at onthemenuradio.com. We always look forward to hearing from you. And On the Menu, we get lots of books, and we get lots of books about chocolates and desserts. Frequently that we cast them on one side and say there couldn't possibly be room for one more book on the subject, but I did pick up one called Discover Chocolate that it turned out a small book, terribly exciting content. I just had to invite the author to join the program, so here he is.
When I got this book, Discover Chocolate, I thought this is a tiny book. There can't really be very much new information in this book. And I was so wrong that I decided it was important to have Clay Gordon, the author of Discover Chocolate, join the program to deal with chocolate myths, to deal with chocolate information that, listeners, you absolutely need to have in order to enjoy what is probably your favorite sweet stuff. Clay, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much, Peter. Thanks for having me on the program today.
And how did you get so involved with chocolate?
Well, I felt my passion for chocolate over the course of the last 12 years as I have been doing the research for becoming a chocolate critic. I came back to the U.S. after a trip to the south of France, and I brought back with me a half a dozen origin chocolate bars. And by origin chocolate bar, I mean a bar where the beans are grown is listed on the label. And I realized after having a dinner party and we sampled these things that where each one of us had a different favorite chocolate for a different reason, that nobody was talking about chocolate the way people were talking about wine. And I said to myself, ooh, there's a market opportunity here. And so I spent 7 years doing the research to teach myself to become a chocolate critic. And it's only been over that period of time where I truly discovered that, you know, I really like this stuff and I really had fun, enjoyed tremendously the process of educating people about good chocolate.
Now, this man is into chocolate, listeners. He founded an organization called the New World Chocolate Society.
Yeah.
And he has a web presence called Discover Chocolate. So he's a real choco-nut, I guess you might say.
I like to call myself a chocophile.
Chocophile, there you
That's
go.
Right.
Not a chocophobe, that's the opposite, correct?
No, not a chocophobe, not at all. Although I can tell you that I have eaten more than my share of bad chocolate over the last 12 years. I mean, many people might say there's no such thing as bad chocolate, but I can certainly assure listeners that there is such a thing.
I'll sneak you a thought from one of the early pages of the book, listeners, just so you can get an idea of what this means. He's Clay lists everything from great to bad chocolate, and he says, bad chocolate, you re-gift only to people that you don't like. Is there some secret about why chocolate is so important, why it's so practically addictive?
Well, I don't think there's a secret. I think there's a difference of opinion. Some people believe that there are chemicals in the chocolate that people become addicted to. And while it is certainly true that there are chemicals that affect brain chemistry and body chemistry and mood, nobody has proven that they're actually there in high enough quantities to become addictive. Other research has proven that chocolate, the cocoa butter in the chocolate, the fat in chocolate, actually melts at just under body temperature, and so it has a texture and a feel in the mouth that's unlike any other food, and it's that sensation of chocolate melting in your mouth which is what is the addictive property of
okay,
chocolate.
Okay, and I remember getting a piece of advice from someone about how to eat their chocolate, and it said you shouldn't chew it. You should let it relax. You know, you should warm it in your mouth before you start to try to ingest it.
Yes and no.
And that would be consistent with this idea of getting it to the right temperature, but then there's a no as well?
Yes, there's a no, because chocolate has two different textures, one of which one is melting and one of which is when it's chewed. I mean, if you put a chocolate in your mouth and let it melt, if the chocolate has a waxy texture, you'll never detect that. And so really what you want to do when you're doing a serious chocolate tasting is after you get done looking at it and smelling at it and put it in your mouth, what you want to do is you want to chew the chocolate 3 or 4 or 5 times just to start the melting process and to get a gauge of the texture. Is it crisp? Is it brittle? Is it waxy? Is it creamy? Those kinds of textures you want to be able to gauge, as well as the texture, as it just melts in your mouth.
Okay, now, I seem to recall, maybe it's a myth, that it was the royalty of the, was it the Incas or the Aztecs, who were the first people to eat chocolate and it was reserved for them. Now, I didn't see that story in your book.
Right.
But is there any truth to that, or is that just something that I read somewhere that's not correct?
Well, the book is deliberately not a history book. There are bunches of other history books, and it's deliberately not a cookbook because there are hundreds of other chocolate cookbooks. And so what I really wanted to do was focus on the individual appreciation of chocolate. It turns out that what we think of as eating chocolate didn't actually exist until the mid-1800s.
Right, before that you drank it in some form.
You drank it, that's correct. So the Aztecs would have drunk it. They would not have eaten it.
No, I recall saying that it was a royal drink.
Right, and it was a royal drink up until the 1700s or thereabouts. If anybody has read, if any of the listeners have read, the memoirs of the Marquis de Sade or Casanova, they do talk about eating chocolate, but what they would have had then would have been a very dry, crumbly, crunchy mixture because there was no way to actually grind either the cocoa particles or the sugar particles very, very fine.
Okay, so you say in your book that the chocolate as we understand it today was a product of the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
When machinery came along that would allow this processing to take place.
Right, and to be able to refine the particles in the chocolate to the point where they could no longer be felt on the tongue. So it wasn't actually until 1879 when Rudolf Lindt invented a device called the conch that what we would actually recognize today as modern eating chocolate, was invented.
Now, there's a controversy out there, in Europe in particular, between the European manufacturers of chocolate and the British manufacturers of chocolate. The people in Europe say British chocolate really isn't any good at all. It's got altogether too much of the wrong kinds of things in it. And, of course, the British look down their noses at Europeans, as they always have.
Right.
Being one of those, I know, being a Brit, I know a lot about that. But is there indeed a difference?
Well, there are differences in style.
Okay.
And so you really, which style you prefer depends primarily on where you grew up. And then, you know, how dedicated you are to being an adventurous eater. But if you grew up in the UK eating Cadbury, then it's actually hard for some people to get used to the idea of French and, say, Spanish styles of chocolate baking, which are much darker, richer, and more bitter. But probably a whole lot easier to get used to the Belgian and Swiss styles of chocolate making, which are lighter and sweeter, which is what the Brits prefer, and which is what the Americans prefer, which is no surprise given, you know, what the dominant culture of colonizing the Americas was.
I discovered a long time ago that I really liked the dark chocolate best.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've been observing recently, and you can share your thoughts about this with us, it seems to me that the emergence of chocolate as a real gourmet item with very high levels of cacao, which you can explain also if you would, in the mix, is now becoming fashionable. We got some chocolate from Theo in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I think, 75% of something.
75% cacao. Well, the percentage measure is an indication of the total weight of the finished product that is derived of cocoa ingredients. So if you have a 100-gram bar and the label says 75% cocoa, then 75 grams by weight of that 100-gram bar is either cocoa powder, the brown stuff, or cocoa butter, the fat which comes from the bean. Right? That's all it says. It's sort of like proof for alcohol. The 86 proof says 43% alcohol. You don't know anything about the quality of the beverage or the taste of the beverage, right?
And the same would be true of chocolate, too.
That same thing is true of chocolate. 70% is just an indicator. It's a quantitative measure,
right?
Not a qualitative measure. But we as Americans over the last 20 years, right, as well as the Europeans, have been like the idea of very, very simple numbering schemes, which allow us to get a handle on something, which is, you know, what Robert Parker has done with his rating system at the Wine Advocate.
Yeah, gotcha. Yes. Yeah.
And I think many people confuse the qualitative number,
okay,
right, which Parker gives, assigns to wines, and other people assign to wines, with a quantitative measure of cocoa content.
So what, but as a general rule, wouldn't you say that someone who's actually bothering to go to the trouble of making 75% chocolate probably is sort of inclined to make better chocolate anyway?
No.
No.
It's a cost issue.
Okay.
I mean, if I have a company that's traditionally been a mass market chocolatier, which means they've been selling product which sells for less than $10 a pound, right, then all of a sudden they get into the premium marketplace, which is chocolate that sells for more than $15 a pound. They probably spend a little more on beans, but not a whole lot. But they still are using continuous process industrial manufacturing techniques, which really doesn't give them the kind of control that they really need in order to be able to develop a superior product. You know, when you are looking at the higher cocoa content chocolates, you really are looking for smaller, batch-processed, artisan stuff, you know, people who are taking the time and attention to be able to do it right.
Now, when you say the time and attention, that means the time and attention devoted to buying the best beans?
All the way through the process.
All the way through, okay.
If necessary, and this is what's beginning to distinguish the best chocolate manufacturers from others, is go to the origin, go to where the beans are grown, work with the farmers, teach them how to ferment, demand high-quality fermentation. And that's easy to do because you just say, I won't buy your beans if they're not fermented properly. Pretty soon the farmer says, okay, I get it. I won't make any money unless I ferment properly.
But only a relatively few people are doing that. I mean, I know we've heard of a lot of chocolate manufacturers, I guess you would call them that, and they buy their chocolate from somebody who's already refined it.
That's certainly very true. And I said it's the distinguishing characteristic of an artisan chocolate manufacturer, as opposed to a mass-market chocolate manufacturer. I mean, it really is. I mean, the world market for cocoa beans around $1,700 a ton right now, and these small-scale artisan chocolate manufacturers are paying $3,500, $4,000 a ton. I mean, paying significantly above the market price.
Okay, all right. So the issue, in fact, is that they're willing to pay a larger amount for a quality product.
Absolutely. And that's where it starts. If you don't have good beans, it's almost impossible to make good chocolate. Yeah. However, it's really easy to make bad chocolate from good beans if you don't pay attention to cleaning them properly, roasting them properly, grinding them properly, and refining and conching them properly. So it really is the differentiation between a good chocolate and a great chocolate is just spending the time and attention at every single step of the process, and don't shortcut anything, but do what is necessary to do it right.
Now, how do people get guidance on where to get good and great chocolate? I mean, you have a list of brands in your book.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a place people can go to?
That's certainly a place that they can go to. I actually do review and rate chocolates at discoverchocolate.com, and there are a number of places around the country and around the world. I mean, one of the better-known sites is actually based out of London. A gentleman by the name of Martin Christie has a site called 70%.com, and he rates and reviews and sells high-end chocolates. There are a bunch of online resources which are also mentioned in the book, so people can go to the book and look for the four or five places where it's, you know, possible to reliably get high-quality chocolate. But in the end, ultimately, it's a matter of personal taste. I mean, one of the things about my book that I did very specifically was not to say, you know, if you don't like the chocolate that I like, then your taste is wrong. Your taste is bad.
No, you talk early in the book about creating your own tasting profile
mm-hmm.
with a pyramid.
Yeah.
So there's, and that's right at the beginning of the book, before you even talk about where chocolate comes from. I think you talk about how to create a profile of what for you is the chocolate that you'll enjoy the most.
Yeah, my publisher and I actually had an argument very early on about what the first chapter of the book was. We eventually decided that the very first chapter of the book should be how to taste chocolate and how to develop your own understanding of what it is you like about the chocolate that you like to eat. And to go there before we went to the chapters of, you know, where cocoa is grown, where cacao is grown, and where chocolate is made or how chocolate is made, because we wanted very much to separate what it is that we were doing from everybody else on the subject.
I think that was a great idea. We read somebody's wine book. I can't remember whose it was. And they started off exactly the same way. They said, first develop your own tasting profile, and here's how to go about doing that.
Right.
And then when you've done that, you'll be in a position where the rest of the book will be much more useful to you.
Right. Well, are you familiar with a UK wine critic and writer by the name of Joanna Simon?
And I'm not. No, I've been out of my native land for a very long time. So I know people like Jancis Robinson and Clive Coates and people like that. But that name escapes me.
Well, Joanna actually wrote a book called Discovering Wine, and it turns out that she starts her book by the whole process of how do you develop your palate. And she was actually very influential in my thinking about, okay, how am I going to write this book?
Let's be a little commercial here. Why should somebody own this book?
Why should somebody own this book? Because they like chocolate or they love chocolate and they want to learn more. I mean, certainly it's my experience that the more I know about how wine is made or cheese is made or olive oils get made or any gourmet food, the more I know about them, the more I can appreciate what it is that I'm eating. And so the primary reason somebody's going to want to own this book is so they can appreciate more the chocolate that they like to eat. I mean, knowing what it is you like about the chocolate that you eat so that when you go and try a new chocolate, you can go, aha, here's what I like about this. This is why I'm not really excited about this chocolate. So ultimately, it's a very, very selfish thing. You know, I want to own this book because I really like chocolate and I want to learn more about why I like chocolate and how I like chocolate.
And there's something about the taste of the brown, black stuff that just gets you, as we talked about at the beginning of the interview, right? It just tastes so damn good.
It's an unusual taste and an unusual texture, right? And when you put those things together and then you add all these chemicals like anandamide and phenylethylamine and theobromine and caffeine and phenylalanine, all these theophylline is what I was looking for, all these other chemicals that do have an effect on mood and body chemistry, that's just the icing on the cake. My personal belief is that several thousand years ago, the chocolate that people were eating there or drinking actually had much, much higher levels of these chemicals in them and really managed to affect their mood. It was a psychoactive food, and they did get hot when they consumed it.
There you go. Now, the book is called Discover Chocolate. You can buy it through the On the Menu bookshelf part of the On the Menu radio website. You can buy it lots of other places, too. And there's an organization associated with that now that Clay has founded called Discover Chocolate. Tell us what the website is there, Clay.
Well, the website is there to ask and answer questions about chocolate. I mean, I post regularly ratings and reviews as well as news on chocolate, which is in the article section. And then there's a section called forums, which is where people can ask questions and have them answered by me, and people can generally participate, although there is a commenting capability on any article that's published anywhere on the website. There's a shop where people can go and buy chocolate and T-shirts and associated gear. There is an area, also another area, called the New World Chocolate Society. It's actually initialed NWCS. And the New World Chocolate Society is something that I founded a couple of years ago to actually promote chocolate that is made in the Americas or chocolate that is made from beans that are grown in the Americas or the New World. Because it turns out that there is phenomenal chocolate that is made here, but most people you know, still retain some chauvinistic tendencies and say, well, you know, I'm only going to eat chocolate from Belgium or I'm only going to eat chocolate from France.
Now, the website is
www.discoverchocolate.com.
There you go. Now, one last question.
Okay.
When you're drinking wine with chocolate, some people think you should drink strong, powerful red wine. Other people say you should drink a white wine that doesn't interfere with the flavor of the chocolate. What's your view on that?
I think that the conventional wisdom, which is sort of like red wine goes with meat and white wine goes with fish, is limiting. It's overly limiting. Not all big, strong red wines go with all dark chocolates. And not all white wines, especially those that have a lot of acidity, like Fumé Blancs and Sauvignon Blancs, will go well with chocolates. In general, I find it easier to do good pairings of red wines with milk chocolates because the butter fat in the milk chocolate has a tendency to cut the acidity and tannins in the red wine. One of my favorite kinds of red wine is a Ripasso, which is a Valpola, which is a red wine made at Valpolicella, in the Valpolicella style.
In Italy, yeah.
But it's soaked on the lees of Amarone.
Okay.
So it gets some of that, but it's, you know, half the price typically of an Amarone. So those are really good wines. I like, you know, my favorite wine for pairing is Prosecco, which is an Italian white sparkling.
Oh, sure, yeah, we know it well.
Because it's very, very creamy, and it pretty much goes with anything, as well as a lot of truffles and bonbons. So it's a great overall wine for pairing. And I always include it in my tasting classes and events because, just number one, it's just a lovely wine to begin with, and it does go pair very, very well.
Well, Clay, time flies when you're having fun. I can't believe we've been talking for more than 20 minutes already,
oh.
And I know you have to go, and I have to go too, but thank you so much for joining, and keep up the good work, and I hope Discover Chocolate becomes as successful as you want it to be.
Well, thank you very much.
It's hard to imagine that we've come to the end of another On the Menu program, but we have. But not to worry. We hope you'll recover from the fact that On the Menu is at end, just as you're recovering from Thanksgiving. We hope you didn't overdo it too much. In our house, we were delighted to have our grandchild and our son and daughter-in-law visiting from South Carolina, and we fixed a small turkey and enjoyed it with them. For those of you who care, Kate is growing up absolutely delightful, the world's best granddaughter, of course, as I'm sure you'd expect us to say. We'll be back same time, same place next week. Next week, I think we're going to feature the 007 of chefs, a British chef called Robert Irvine, who's cooked for thousands of people on the beaches of South Yemen, as well as for Her Majesty the Queen and Prince Charles, the Duke of Windsor. Who knows, probably some interesting new ingredients that we just discovered as well. So you'll be sure to have another exciting time if you tune in once more to www.onthemenuradio.com. Listeners, thank you so much and have a great week.